This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome to Psychiatry Today with Dr. Scott. This is Dr. Scott Bay, your psychiatrist on America's Web Radio, and your source for all the latest mental health-related news. It's about the mind, the brain, human behavior, how to feel well emotionally, how to cope better with stress, how to rid yourself of bad habits, and how to make sense of media reports about research into the latest potential new treatments and the causes of mental illness. This is where you'll hear all about it first, without the hype and distortion of other media sources, and with the benefit of more than 20 years of private practice of psychiatry, along the way trying to better educate the general public about mental health issues and trying to reduce the stigma associated with having a psychiatric diagnosis and needing treatment for it. And welcome again, ladies and gentlemen. Appreciate your tuning into the show. This is the Wednesday, November 5th, 2014 edition of Psychiatry Today. This past Saturday night, or very early Sunday morning, we turned the clocks back for fall, no longer in daylight savings time. So the days are decidedly shorter. Hope those of you who suffer from seasonal affective disorder, or if not full-blown SAD, at least mood changes as a result of the shorter days, took steps to address this, such as starting to go to sleep a little bit earlier each night for the past couple of weeks. But now that it's here, the change has taken place, and we're a few days into it already, the best surefire way to counteract the blahs from the shorter days is to take advantage of mornings when it's sunny. And I know they're not always going to be sunny now that we're into fall and on the threshold of winter, but when it is sunny, even if it's cold, try as best you can to take advantage of it, get outside, spend some time in the sun early in the morning, not too late in the day. That would shift your daytime clock ahead too far and make it hard to sleep at night. So early in the morning, get some sun. If it's just so cold that you can't stand it and you're stuck inside, at least open all the drapes, blinds, curtains, whatever, very wide. Let all the sun in that you can. And that will go a long way toward counteracting those winter doldrums from the shorter days. Well, you know, one of my main motivations for doing the show is to let people know that mental illness is a real thing. It is a physical thing. It can be documented by such physical studies of the body, like brain imaging, that there are changes in the brain that take place when someone suffers from mental illness, that you can see these changes be reversed when people recover. And you know, to me, this is surefire proof for those who are, quite frankly, ignorant, don't know any other way to say it, and who don't understand that there is such a thing as mental illness, that people who suffer from it cannot simply snap out of it or pull themselves up or whatever you want to say. And so now, here is a study that shows you can also document brain changes as a result of psychotherapy, not just taking medication to treat mental illness. You know, so this is certainly also surefire proof, not only that there is such a thing as mental illness, but that treatments for it that do not involve medication or electricity or magnetism or any of these other things that are used to treat depression actually work, and that they actually bring about changes in the brain that can be demonstrated and documented with very sophisticated brain imaging techniques. So very excited to bring that to you, and therefore that's what's leading off this week's show. It's PET scans, positron emission tomography, that's what PET stands for, reveal how psychodynamic psychotherapy, in particular, for depression, can change brain function. And this comes to us from no less than Massachusetts General Hospital, the flagship facility of Harvard Medical School, where investigators identified, they say for the first time, changes in the metabolic activity of a key brain region in patients successfully treated for depression with psychodynamic psychotherapy, suggesting a mechanism of action behind one of the most historically important and widely practiced forms of therapy. They also found evidence that pre-treatment metabolism in a different brain structure might predict which patients are likely to respond to that form of therapy. Their report will be appearing in the journal Psychotherapy and Psychosomatics and has already been issued online. Now, I said before that they say it's the first time these changes have taken place because certainly I recall reading and hearing about studies many, many years ago, as long as, say, 8 or 10 years ago or even longer, documenting that, yes, you can show changes on PET scans showing recovery from depression using psychotherapy alone as treatment. So as far as the specifics of them saying this is a first, can't really speak to that. The other studies that I reference, perhaps it wasn't this particular type of therapy, psychodynamic psychotherapy. Perhaps it was different brain regions. But in general, I would say that while this is certainly an extremely important finding, that it's certainly not the first time that brain imaging has been able to show that mental illness can be successfully treated with psychotherapy alone, based on changes in brain function shown on PET scans. Now let's take a look at psychodynamic therapy for a moment, because again, the different types of psychotherapies that therapists practice, they're talked about as if they're extremely unique and distinct methods, but in the practical everyday reality of patients seeing therapists, I don't know that many of them stick to just one specified technique all the time. I think most therapists are somewhat eclectic in their approach, and any given therapist's psychotherapeutic techniques certainly encompass methods and ideas from multiple different types of therapies. Considered to be a successor of Freudian analysis, psychodynamic psychotherapy focuses on how a patient's prior life experiences, particularly important relationships, influence their character and how they relate to others. Through exploration of a patient's past and current relationships, including the relationship with the therapist, therapy focuses on helping the patient gain insights that can change both mood and behavior. Now, after that description, you can see how this is, as they describe it, a successor of Freudian psychoanalysis. According to the authors, psychodynamic psychotherapy might be considered the original form of personalized medicine, since it draws directly from a patient's unique experiences to shape the course of treatment. And while it has been a core part of psychiatric training for decades and continues to be widely practiced, psychodynamic psychotherapy hasn't been studied as broadly as have other approaches for a number of reasons, including its greater subjectivity and also treatment-by-treatment variability. We do know that psychodynamic treatments are effective for some patients, and this study examined whether differences in brain activity could predict which patients would complete the course of therapy and which would drop out, a common occurrence for any type of psychotherapy. The study enrolled 16 patients, a very small number, all diagnosed with major depression, for whom previous treatment with medication had not been successful. So right off the bat, you know you're dealing with a very ill, difficult-to-treat group of people. Prior to the beginning of the therapy program, participants received standardized assessments of their own depression symptoms and of psychological mindedness. What does that mean? Well, psychological mindedness is the capacity to recognize and understand their own emotions, motivations, and actions. Before the first therapy session, participants had a PET imaging procedure that assesses metabolic activity within the brain by measuring glucose uptake. That's the method by which PET looks at brain activity. You see what areas are using the most glucose. Those are the ones that are the most active. Now, just another word about psychological mindedness. Someone has to have some degree of that. Again, it refers to being able to recognize and understand your emotions, motivations, and actions. If you don't have some degree of psychological mindedness, you're probably not going to benefit from psychotherapy. It requires that degree of the ability to be introspective in order for you to benefit from it. So that's why it was very important that they looked at this characteristic in these research subjects. Now, the study protocol involved 16 weekly individual psychodynamic psychotherapy sessions that, while flexible enough to be adapted to individual patients' needs, followed a predefined theme and sequence. All right, and we're going to get to our first commercial break now, so we'll go on at greater length to describe the study protocol and what the results were when we come back for our commercial break. You're listening to Psychiatry Today with Dr. Scott. Be right back.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
This is Denise Simon. 18 hours a day, I live in a world as an intelligence analyst. What I find is reprehensible, what I find is terrifying, what I find is treasonous. The mainstream media has completely failed the American people. So join me for the Denise Simon Experience every Thursday night at 9 p.m. Eastern.
Watchdog is a term given an organization like the United States Justice Foundation, which since 1979 has been watching out and, when necessary, taking the appropriate action, from testifying to litigating to protect our constitutional rights. USJF, a nonprofit organization, is nationally recognized not only as a watchdog, but many in the government, as well as those involved in legal cases, have also called the USJF a bulldog for the tenacious approach in their presentation and proof of what is right. Find out more at www.usjf.net. Support USJF as they support you.
This is Dr. Susan Blank, Medical Director for the Atlanta Healing Center. Our team is able to offer a multitude of treatment options, such as quantitative EEG, also known as brain mapping, hormonal and nutritional assessments, neuropsychological testing, and cognitive therapy, along with traditional 12-step facilitation. And we can even offer you, if appropriate, a gentle medically managed detox. Please contact us at 770-696-9862.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to Psychiatry Today with your host, psychiatrist Dr. Scott Bay. with all your mental health-related news. Continuing our discussion of a study done at Harvard documenting that psychotherapy alone as a treatment for depression brings about changes in the brain that you can see on brain imaging studies. Now, with participants' permission, psychotherapy sessions were videotaped and later reviewed by another member of the study team, in other words, other than the one doing the therapy, both to ensure that sessions followed the defined pattern and to assess how well participants developed new insights through the therapy. Now, 7 participants discontinued therapy, while 9 completed all therapy sessions, which were followed by a second set of PET scan images taken within a week of the therapy's conclusion, and then a repeat assessment of depression symptoms. So out of 16 people, 7 didn't even finish the sessions, 9 continued. That's kind of a concern right there, if you ask me, and I think that it limits to some extent the utility of the conclusions the researchers could reach. I would love to see this done with a much larger group of subjects so that you could account for such a high dropout rate. Well, we'll look at what they found regardless. Now, the PET scans taken before they started the psychotherapy showed that metabolic activity of the insula on the right side of the brain. The insula is a brain region known to be important for emotional regulation, and it's an area that's previously been implicated in depression. So the activity of that area was higher in the participants that had the more severe depression symptoms. Almost all of those subjects who completed the therapy had a greater than 50% reduction in depression symptoms, although improvement was not really clinically evident until at least after the 4th week of treatment on average. Reduced metabolic activity within the insula, comparing after treatment to pre-treatment, was associated with greater symptom reduction and was correlated with the degree of insight each participant achieved as determined by the outside observers. Meaning that if you saw very severe depression as shown by high activity in the insula before psychotherapy, then you treat someone with psychotherapy and it seems to be successful based on the outside observers concluding that the person achieved a high degree of insight, then what you saw afterwards was the activity in the insula going down. Okay, so this is how they're documenting. Look, you're seeing these changes in the brain when someone is depressed, and you see those things get better after they're successfully treated with psychotherapy. Now, the pre-treatment PET scans also showed significant metabolic differences in a different area of the brain. This one was the right precuneus. And again, there were differences between those who went on to complete the therapy and those who dropped out. There was a higher metabolic level in this brain area in the people who completed treatment. Now, this is the opposite. In the insula, those who were successfully treated saw the activity in that area go down. And in the precuneus, the successful completers of treatment went up. Now, this area of the brain, the precuneus, has been previously associated with self-awareness and memory. And that makes sense. If you see activity go up in that area, that's associated with better self-awareness, better ability to be in touch with your emotions and motivations, and better ability to achieve insight through psychotherapy. And so it's not hard to see that this area was associated with the pre-treatment level of psychological mindedness. Again, the capacity that has been considered essential to successful psychodynamic psychotherapy treatment, being able to be in touch with your emotions and motivations. Now, as with all psychiatric interventions, it is notoriously difficult to know ahead of time who is likely to have a good response to psychodynamic psychotherapy and who is not. Now, if there were biological markers that could predict success, that would be a major development in terms of being able to tailor in treatment to the individual and therefore ensure more successful outcomes of treatment. Now, while the measured differences between the people who completed treatment and those who didn't complete treatment as far as psychological mindedness are insignificant, when you look at the activity in the precuneus, it suggests that might be a sensitive predictor of treatment response, and definitely something that they hope to follow up with larger trials. Now, this is quite interesting and all well and good, but does this mean that before putting a patient through a course of psychodynamic psychotherapy, researchers are suggesting that people have a PET scan and those with high activity in your precuneus? Okay, great. That means you're capable of psychological mindedness. That means you should have psychodynamic psychotherapy. Whereas someone who does not show high activity in their precuneus, you're going to say, well, okay, then you're not such a great candidate for psychodynamic psychotherapy. We're going to find some other way to treat you. PET scans are quite expensive. You're also injecting into the body in order to image the brain a radioactive tracer. So it would seem to me this is rather an impractical way of screening candidates for psychodynamic psychotherapy. But nonetheless, even though it's not practically useful, at least in its present form, it certainly does give us some fascinating insights into the correlations between characteristics that we see in people and that we use in their response to psychotherapy and actual activity in certain very specific structures in the brain. So this is quite fascinating, and those who are interested in the crossover, as it were, between brain science and neuroscience and neuroanatomy and the structure of the brain and thought and emotion certainly must find this fascinating, as I think it is. So there you go. An interesting correlation between therapy, the response to it or not, and actual observed changes in the brain. Next up on tonight's show, for years I've been talking about how there's a strong correlation between psychiatric illness and other medical problems. You've heard me talk about this quite often if you're a regular or long-time listener. Again, trying to reinforce the point that mental illness not only is real, but it has consequences for the rest of the body and for overall health, rather than just being an isolated issue. Now, here comes another study showing that people with mental health disorders are twice as likely to suffer heart disease or stroke. People facing mental health challenges are significantly more likely to have heart disease or stroke, according to a study presented last week, at the Canadian Cardiovascular Congress. The mentally ill population is at high risk, and it's even greater for people with multiple mental health issues. Using data from the Canadian Community Health Survey, The authors explored the associations between cardiovascular risk and disease, mental health disorders, and the use of psychiatric medication. The study found that people who have had a mental health disorder at any point in their life were twice as likely to have had heart disease or have experienced a stroke. Those who haven't developed heart disease or had a stroke are more likely to be at high long-term risk of developing cardiovascular disease when compared to the general population. People who used psychiatric medications were twice as likely to have heart disease and three times as likely to have had a stroke compared to those not taking these medications. Now, on that last point, before anyone is tempted to just blame the medications for the heart disease and stroke, let's keep in mind that overall the correlation is between being mentally ill and being at risk for heart disease or stroke. And so if someone is on the medication, rather than the medication being at fault, it may simply be the case that the more severe your symptoms are, then obviously the greater the likelihood your treatment is going to warrant and or require treatment with medication. And therefore, it's the correlation with being more severely mentally ill with stroke and heart attack and not the medications per se. Although the study authors did have some concerns about the effects of the medications, and we'll be getting to that later. Now, the study included people with a wide variety of mental illnesses, including schizophrenia, bipolar disorders, major depressive and anxiety disorders. And among the psychiatric drugs examined were the antipsychotics, antidepressants, benzodiazepines, which are sedatives, and mood stabilizing medications. Now, what accounts for the elevated risk? Well, the authors of the study found three main factors in terms of the contributing factors that demonstrate this correlation between mental health disorders and increased risk of heart attack and stroke. And I think what we'll do is we'll, rather than start and be interrupted, let's take our next commercial break now, and we'll get into that after we come back. You're listening to Psychiatry Today with Dr. Scott. Be right back after this break.
This is Dr. George from Peachtree ENT Center. Understanding health insurance is becoming more challenging. If you currently have insurance, you've probably noticed that it costs more to see your doctor. And if you were able to keep your doctor, it takes longer to get an appointment. The bad news is this trend is projected to continue. Your costs will continue to rise while your health care choice and access will continue to fall. The good news is Peachtree ENT Center has the answer to this problem. We are committed to working with you. We specialize in providing affordable care for patients without insurance, those who are underinsured, and those with high deductibles or catastrophic coverage. And we offer same-day appointments. You no longer have to choose between staying healthy and paying bills because Peachtree ENT Center is where patient care counts.
Don't be hoodwinked by the left, who wants you to believe the fairy tale that we can power America on butterflies, rainbows, and pixie dust. I'm Marita Noon. Get the truth about energy on my show, America's Voice for Energy, only on America's Web Radio.
This is Dr. Susan Blank, Medical Director for the Atlanta Healing Center. Our team is able to offer a multitude of treatment options such as quantitative EEG, also known as brain mapping, hormonal and nutritional assessments, neuropsychological testing, and cognitive therapy, along with traditional 12-step facilitation. And we can even offer you, if appropriate, a gentle medically managed detox. Please contact us at 770-696-9862.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to Psychiatry Today. Once again, your host, psychiatrist Dr. Scott Bay, talking about a study documenting the links between mental health disorders and heart disease and stroke. Now, the three main factors that researchers found in terms of this connection were that first, people with mental health disorders often exhibit behavioral risk factors including smoking, drinking, poor diet, and physical inactivity. For instance, 40 to 90% of people with mental illness smoke compared to 20% of the general population. And again, this was in Canada, but the statistics are comparable in the United States. Psychiatric medications are another issue. Some of them can induce weight gain and impair the breakdown of fats and sugars by the body. This can lead to obesity, high cholesterol, and diabetes. So the researchers think that the medications themselves account for a lot of risk in this group. And while that's very true of some of the medications, especially the antipsychotics, this is a factor that certainly could be overcome with proper health education and proper motivation on the part of the patients to exercise and diet, which is a lot easier said than done for people who suffer from mental illness. And thirdly, is the access to health care. And I think this is the biggest factor. Patients with mental health disorders often don't pay very much attention to their own medical care. They may not even have a primary care physician. If they do, they may not go for regular checkups and may not follow health recommendations. Furthermore, they may have difficulty communicating their health needs over and above just not seeking care because of their disorder. Now, a separation that exists between primary care and mental health services challenges the care of these patients, which is why in recent times the buzzword has been collaborative care, integrated models. Now, another factor that I think is important where it concerns the lack of adequate health care for people with mental illness has been addressed by the study authors. There is, of course, still stigma associated with mental illness. But part of the ugly reality of that is that this stigma can even affect the care that health professionals provide. That's right. Health care professionals who have stigma about mental illness, who may harbor prejudices against the mentally ill, may not treat the medical, physical problems of the mentally ill the same or as aggressively as those without mental illness. A very ugly and sad assertion, but unfortunately I think that's true. For example, they found that those with mental health disorders are less likely to receive risk-reducing drug therapies or to undergo coronary procedures, such as bypass surgery. Now, it is very important that people have their mental health issues treated and also be proactive in speaking with their providers about their overall health, all their health care providers, including their primary care physician. The prevention strategies for heart attack and stroke are no different for people with mental health issues than they are for anyone else. That means eating a healthy diet, being physically active, being smoke-free, managing stress, which of course is more of a challenge for those who are mentally ill, and limiting alcohol consumption, which really by rights the mentally ill should not have any at all, or at least as little as possible, as seldom as possible. Making positive health behavior changes is important to physical health and mental health as well. Ongoing follow-up with medical professionals is essential, and even if certain medications can have some risks, the benefits in most cases outweigh the risks. So it's important that people talk to their doctors, continue to take their prescribed medications, and follow healthy behaviors. I can cite at least one example from my own practice where a patient's not just their primary care physician, their diabetes specialist took into account that this person has a serious mental illness. They have to stay on their medication with side effects, including making it a challenge to keep blood sugar in control. So rather than to tell the patient, hey, you need to tell your psychiatrist, in this case it was me, you have to get off this medication, it's aggravating your diabetes. In fact, the diabetes specialist told the patient, no, it's okay, I understand you need to take that. I can manage your blood sugar. I know you have to stay on that medication. Quite frankly, folks, when I heard that, I was shocked, even somewhat moved, because more often than not, we psychiatrists are not given such support and cooperation from our medical colleagues in terms of having to manage patients' serious mental illnesses with medications that may have significant side effects. So to hear that this physician, again, this was a specialist, this was not a primary care physician, saying, you know what, I know you have to take this, we'll just have to do what we can to manage your diabetes more aggressively to take that into account. That was more than a breath of fresh air, I can tell you that. But the take-home message from this Canadian study, and again, this situation is quite comparable here in the U.S., is that people with mental illness need to have regular checkups just like everyone else, need to have good diet and exercise and not smoke just like everyone else in order to minimize their risk of heart attack and stroke. And yes, the medications may present an additional challenge, but again, that challenge should be met with appropriate countermeasures from the patient making appropriate choices in diet and getting enough exercise, and from the primary care physician or other specialists managing measures such as blood sugar and blood cholesterol with appropriate medical treatment. Well, next up on psychiatry today, we have a child and adolescent mental health update. Specifically, this has to do with adolescents. So those of you who have teenage children or grandchildren, as the case may be, who may have suffered mental health problems in the past, I strongly suggest you listen up to this. Because according to a new study, parent and peer disapproval can lead to teen suicide. Now, we all want to know what possibly could lead to teen suicide and how we could prevent it. So, therefore, the study raises some important issues. Teens who have already attempted suicide or tried to harm themselves are the group that's specifically being looked at by the study, because these kids are more likely to try again to kill themselves or to hurt themselves if they think that their parents or their peers invalidate their feelings, according to this new study. Now, what does invalidated mean? People can feel invalidated when they feel someone's not listening to them, or when someone just negates their feelings, for example. So if someone doesn't feel that their parents or their peers are being supportive in the wake of an episode in which they tried to harm themselves or even made an attempt on their life, and they're simply negating their feelings, maybe reacting with, well, I can't believe you did that. What's wrong with you? Why could you do such a thing? Your life is good. Why are you depressed? Things like that. These are examples of feelings not being validated or being invalidated. Whereas if peers and parents responded more supportively, what is wrong that you were feeling so bad that you did that? And, you know, how can I help you get through this without resorting to doing something like that to yourself? You know, that's validating the person's feelings, and you might notice not necessarily overindulging them either. because I'm sure there are people out there listening to think, well, if you can run the risk of overindulging these feelings and even encouraging attention-seeking behavior. And you're absolutely right, and I'm sensitive to that. But still, it is important to validate those feelings, because you never can tell when the self-harm gesture was something that was quote-unquote just for attention, and when it was a serious cry for help that could eventually lead to suicide if not paid enough attention to. Now, adolescent boys with serious psychiatric problems who felt invalidated by their peers were more likely to mutilate themselves. Researchers interviewed 99 teenagers and their parents when the children were admitted to psychiatric facilities because of a suicide attempt or elevated suicide risk, and then they were interviewed again 6 months later. To measure the teenager's perception of invalidation, researchers asked questions like, were there times when you did not feel accepted by your family? Were there times when you did not feel accepted by your classmates? Within half a year, 35 of the teens had attempted suicide or displayed signs of heightened risk. Boys who felt their parents didn't validate their feelings were more likely to have a suicidal event, and girls who felt invalidated by their peers were more likely to self-mutilate. Now, this article came from the Journal of Child and Adolescent Psychopharmacology. There is a comment by the lead researcher who differentiates between validation and support. Validating a child's sense of identity, what they are, is important. You can have social support and still feel invalidated. Well, we'll take a commercial break and we'll get back with more results from the study. You're listening to Psychiatry Today with Dr. Scott.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
In 2009, the membership organization Docs for Patient Care was founded. People all around the country wanted to participate in the efforts of this group, and they wanted to join, but they were unable to do so unless they were physicians. It's for this reason that the Docs for Patient Care Foundation was created. Now, everyone can join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. While you're at your computer, please go to www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org and make a tax-deductible donation and join the fight along with us. Thank you.
This is Dr. George from Peachtree Ear, Nose, and Throat Center. We've won patient care awards and have the highest patient recommendations because I believe in practicing medicine the old-fashioned way. Practicing good medicine is based in listening to the patient and making a care plan that is individualized. The best medical care is given when there is a strong doctor-patient relationship built on mutual trust and respect. At Peachtree ENT Center, we believe in taking care of the whole patient because healing is more than writing a prescription. Whether you have problems hearing or your child has frequent throat infections, from the time you call our office and speak to a real person, you'll be treated as an individual, not an ailment. During your visit, you'll not be rushed, and all of your questions will be answered. And when possible, I will recommend natural treatments to fix the problem. If surgery is recommended, cost-effective, minimally invasive treatment for snoring, sleep apnea, or sinus problems will be offered, because Peachtree ENT Center is where patient care counts. If you'd like to make an appointment, call 404-591-9100 or reach us on the web at www.peachtreeentcenter.com.
This is Dr. Susan Blank, Medical Director for the Atlanta Healing Center. Our team is able to offer a multitude of treatment options, such as quantitative EEG, also known as brain mapping, hormonal and nutritional assessments, neuropsychological testing, and cognitive therapy, along with traditional 12-step facilitation. And we can even offer you, if appropriate, a gentle, medically managed detox. Please contact us at 770-696-9862.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to Psychiatry Today. Dr. Scott Bay, your host, with you. And we're continuing our discussion of how parent and peer disapproval can actually lead to teen suicide. Now, a boy who feels depressed or anxious and hears from a parent that he has no reason to be depressed or anxious, that is invalidation. And being invalidated by an otherwise supportive family is really just, you know, having their feelings negated. And then when you hear about cases of teen suicide, of people who seem to have everything, we need to ask more questions in evaluating a teen's support system. Does the teen really feel like they can talk to their friends and family? Do they feel like they're listened to? Now, suicide is the second leading cause of death among 13 to 17-year-olds, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention here in Atlanta. You remember a recent longevity study in the United States found that it's the 10th leading cause of death overall. But again, among 13 to 17-year-olds, the second leading cause of death. Nearly 16% of high school students in a 2011 nationwide study reported seriously considered killing themselves in the previous year, and almost 8% reported a suicide attempt during the prior year. A 2009 publication from the American Psychological Association estimated that 14 to 21% of teens and young adults inflict self-harm by cutting and burning themselves. Researchers believe people self-mutilate for a range of reasons, including as self-punishment and simply as a way to feel something. Of the 99 participants in the current study, 64 were girls and 23 were boys. Within 6 months, 21 girls and 14 boys attempted suicide or showed elevated suicidal risk, and 25 girls and 15 boys mutilated themselves. 21 kids had experienced both problems. Girls were significantly more likely to have high perceived family invalidation of their feelings when first questioned in the hospital. But perceived family invalidation of their feelings was more likely to trigger suicide in boys. 2/3 of the boys who initially reported high family invalidation attempted suicide or were at elevated risk within 6 months. Of the 25 girls who engaged in self-mutilation within 6 months, 72% reported high family invalidation of their feelings at the beginning. Of the 15 boys who engaged in self-mutilation at 6 months, 2/3 reported high perceived peer invalidation at the beginning. The study underscores the need for parents to take adolescents' worries seriously. Again, not necessarily to overindulge, but not to ignore them or fail to take them seriously enough. Sometimes it can feel to parents that their child can be having an overblown reaction, and they might want to tell their child it's no big deal and to calm down. And that can feel extremely invalidating to kids. There is the need for parents to take any talk of suicide seriously every time. Some people say they may just be trying to get attention, and that may indeed be true some of the time. But it's very important that adults who hear a child talking about suicide at all have that child evaluated by a trained mental health professional. It is literally a matter of life and death. Because the fact is that although there may be people who, simply threaten suicide and do so repeatedly for attention, may go on to eventually kill themselves. Now let's move on to the bizarre case of very strange behavioral reactions that some patients are having to medications used to treat Parkinson's disease and restless leg syndrome. Dopamine receptor agonist drugs are used to treat both of these disorders, and they were linked with higher risks for pathological gambling, hypersexuality, and compulsive shopping in a new study. Cases of these severe impulse control disorders were linked to the drugs, and this has been reported for more than 10 years now. In many cases, the abnormal behavior stops when patients stop taking the medications. The Parkinson's Disease Foundation says on its website that in one earlier study, dopamine agonists were linked with compulsive behaviors in up to 14% of patients. Researchers analyzed 2.7 million serious drug side effects reported in the Food and Drug Administration Adverse Event Reporting System between 2003 in 2012 in the United States and 21 other countries. They identified almost 1,600 impulse control disorder events, 710 of them linked to dopamine agonist drugs, and 870 of them associated with other drugs. The dopamine agonists were most often prescribed for Parkinson's disease, but were also sometimes prescribed for restless leg syndrome. Dopamine agonist drugs were 277 times more likely to result in a report of specific impulse control symptoms than other drugs. This tells you that reports associating a drug with pathological gambling or hypersexuality are extremely rare, except for this group of drugs. That's a large increase in risk, and the actual risk could be in fact higher, since these data rely on official reports of drug side effects. Now, the results of this new study appeared online on October 20th in the Journal of the AMA Internal Medicine. There was also a link between impulse control disorders and antidepressants or antipsychotics, but not as powerful as the link with the Parkinson's drugs, meaning it's much less frequently that you see impulse control disorders that are attributed to antidepressants or antipsychotics. Now, these dopamine agonist drugs include Mirapex, Requip, and Cyclocet, and Apokine. The generic names are Pramipexole for Mirapex, Ropinirole for Requip, Cabergoline and Bromocriptine, Rotigotine and Apomorphine. Now, the more common ones really are the Mirapex, which is Pramipexole, and the Requip, which is Ropinirole. These dopamine agonists activate dopamine receptors even in the absence of dopamine itself, which of course is depleted from the brain in Parkinson's disease. Dopamine plays a complex role in regulating behavior. So drugs that affect the way the brain uses dopamine may reduce the threshold for impulsive behaviors. especially in Parkinson's disease, where there's a depletion of brain cells that use dopamine, and the medications are designed to replace that deficiency, you're increasing dopamine in these patients' brains. And in a small number of them, in any case, it can trigger these impulsive behaviors. These compelling results are some of the best evidence we may be able to get concerning the behavioral consequences of dopamine agonist drugs. And it's difficult to study because many patients may not want to disclose their gambling or sexual behavior problems. The bottom line is that if you or someone close to you has to take one of these drugs for either Parkinson's disease or restless leg syndrome, again, it's a small minority of patients who have these problems, but you should be monitored closely in case any of these things happen. Now, let's turn to a study showing there's a lot of patients who are in pain in the United States. A new study in the Journal of Pain says 39 million people in the U.S. are 19% of persistent pain. The incidence varies according to age and gender. Researchers define persistent pain as frequent or constant pain lasting longer than 3 months. Now, the study used data from the 2010 Quality of Life Supplement of the National Health Interview Survey. Results show approximately 19% of adults had persistent pain in 2010, older adults more likely than younger, women more likely than men. Persistent pain affects other quality of life issues, as well, especially causing anxiety, depression, and fatigue. Individuals with those conditions, in turn, have more likely to have persistent pain. Now, the back pain was prevalent in 60% of adults over the last 3 months of the survey. And then, of course, the public health perspective of this information is very important, because those with persistent pain have very high rates of work disability and fatigue and anxiety and depression. And they're also at higher risk for long-term exposure to and chemical dependency on pain medications. The authors concluded that measuring pain persistence has policy implications, because persistent pain is an indicator of an unmet medical need for pain management in the general population, as well as a risk factor for anxiety and depression. The chronic pain leads to anxiety and depression in turn aggravates the pain. You see this a lot with products touted on television that were formerly used to treat anxiety and depression and are now touted for treatment of pain. Well, with that, we're going to have to wrap up tonight's show. I hope you enjoyed the information that I enjoyed bringing to you and found it interesting and informative, and I hope that you have a wonderful, stress-free week until we get together again next week. But if not, then you need to call Dr. Scott. Good night, and thanks for listening.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.